People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this special edition of PTR, we bring you a speech by Plowshares activist Philip Berrigan. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno de Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. On December 19, 1999, Philip Berrigan participated in a Plowshares versus depleted uranium action at the Warfield Air National Guard Base in Maryland. Berrigan was sentenced to prison for attempting to disarm two A-10 Thunderbolt airplanes, also known as Warthogs. He was released on December 14th of 2001. He spoke at the Atlantic Life Community Retreat on December 28th. Special thanks to Jesse Lynn for providing us this copy of his speech.
From time to time during this last stretch, I've had to reflect what having people in jail meant to a community at home. And it meant a vast expenditure of not only time, but money and effort and letters and all the elements of support. And some would realize that the folks at home have it a hell of a lot tougher than we did. I think the whole prison evolution here in the United States could have happened even earlier. I remember a very significant book done by Robert J. Lifton and Richard Falk called Indefensible Weapons. And in it, they just promoted an obvious thesis that if you're into nuclearism, you're into totalitarianism. And fascism is inevitable. Now, in that context, of course, prisons are inevitable, and maybe even our prison development here in this country is late coming. I'd like to share some very, very heavy stuff with you that I don't make on my own authority, and that would have to do largely with the studies of Dr. Rosalie Bertel from Toronto. She's a world-class epidemiologist, and she's one of the few scientists in the world who have had the competence and guts to release information like came out within the last year or 18 months. And she says, in effect, nuclear war has already happened. It hasn't happened in the way we imagined it would happen, but it's happened. And hundreds of millions of people have already died or have been diseased or maimed because it has happened. And then the seeds of further human destruction are all now implanted in the planet. And the death toll, by way of expectation, can be looked upon as mounting all the time. So she says, since 1945 and the first test at Alamogordo, New Mexico, the nuclear club has killed, maimed, or diseased 1.3 billion people. Now make sure you've heard me right and heard her right. She says 1.3 billion people. 1,300 million. So we as Americans, since we're in love with our country, since we would like to take it back from the bosses and warriors, we're interested in what our share of that kind of horrific action is. And conservatively, it's one half, perhaps 60%. We kicked it off and led it all the way. And the last study I've heard about the expenditure of that is by the Brookings Institute, which is a conservative think tank here in Washington, D.C. Last I read, $19 trillion on past, present, future wars. That's how much us Americans treasure our violence because it secures our lifestyle. And we like living like we do. We are consuming from the planet 6 to 7 times our share right now. And we're a drain upon the world. And in the eyes of many, including the Muslim world, we're a curse upon the world. Now, where does it come from? Well, United Nations studies have said that most of it comes from testing. And I was appalled in reading Bertel's latest book, where she speaks about the warmongers using the planet Earth as their latest weapon, using the resources and the facilities and the riches of the Earth as their latest weapon. Included in testing would be the fact that we have exploded maybe up in the upper stratosphere or ionosphere 8 nuclear devices, some of them hydrogen bombs. What goes up comes down, and it comes down upon the Earth. In addition, we have had at least 3 space vehicles that we know about carrying heavy doses of plutonium, 17,000 curies apiece, that have crashed upon the Earth. And people are dying, not only from cancer, but the radiation depresses the human immune system. It depresses it, it weakens it. It makes you a pushover for a whole galaxy of other diseases. Where else? 4 nuclear wars now, done by the United States. Not only Japan, 1945, but also Iraq, Yugoslavia, and now Afghanistan with depleted uranium, which the spin doctors from the Pentagon would say is not a nuclear weapon at all. Maybe the most noxious and the most insidious of the whole nuclear weapon school, depleted uranium. The next element. We've got 103 nuclear power plants here in this country, and study after study after study have indicated that the incidence of cancer and other related disease is astronomically higher within a close radius of these plants. They shut one down in California called Rancho Seco, and they found that infanticide and birth deformities eased off radically as soon as the damn plant was shut down. And they're all 3 Mile Island, you know, Fermi outside of Detroit, on and on and on. They're all polluting air, soil, and water. A Japanese team came over after 3 Mile Island, and they discovered trees in 4 seasons. 1 tree in 4 seasons because of what happened at 3 Mile Island. And now our peerless leaders, Cheney and the rest of them, are advocating a new species of nuclear plant that doesn't even contain a containment vessel. We've got about 149 nuclear weapon stations where the weapons, one component or the other, has been turned out. The Department of Energy, with no shame at all, announces that 109 of them can't be cleaned up. Paducah in Kentucky, you know, Fernald outside of Cincinnati, Hanford, Washington, can't be cleaned up. So you make what they call national sacrifice zones out of these places. You put a fence around them, or you go ahead and mothball them with concrete. Anyway, you keep the public out, vast acreage, beautiful ecology before this social pollution came in. And so it goes on. And we've got about maybe 8 million tons of exposed uranium tailings, see, around the planet. In South Africa, in Western Canada, Southwest United States, Australia, Belgian Congo, see, wherever this deadly junk has been mined. Now Australia. Yeah. Kieran O'Reilly and Trina Lenthal did an action against the new uranium mines in Australia. So, what happens with all these exposed tailings? Well, the rainfall leaches it into the water system. The wind picks up radioactivity from the tailings itself and just circulates it. And people die as a result. You can see the potential. So be convinced of this, that nuclear war has already happened, that the American share of this is about 650 million people since 1945. That amounts to a Holocaust every year since 1945, a Holocaust of 12 or 13 million, comparable to the one suffered by Jewish people and by dissidents under the Nazis, and it's now implanted, see? And that people like ourselves are the only resource against this kind of social psychosis. I was much taken with the 8th chapter of John's Gospel, where our Lord gets into heavy controversy with what is called the Judeans, the temple state crowd. And he asks them a simple question. He says, "What are you trying to kill me for?" And they say, "Well, who's trying to kill you? You're nothing but, I mean, you got the mentality of a Samaritan," another hated people. And he says, "Well, you're trying to kill me because of your father. And your father's not Abraham. Your father is Satan." And then he begins to do something that I've never found in any of world literature. And you can take that for what it's worth, because all of us ought to have our nose stuck in that Bible on a daily basis. It's written for our instruction. He links lying and murder. And he links them both with demonism. And he says, if you're into killing people, you're possessed. You're into demonism. You're into devil worship. I've seen where the demons are demythologized. They're stripped of their covering. You want to kill another person? Okay, you're opening yourself up for demonic possession. Because we're sisters and brothers of one another, and God knows he or she did not intend us to be killing one another. So I'll just end it on there. A few footnotes on the war, on this nasty little rhubarb going on in Afghanistan. It's been 5 years in preparation since 1970, 1996, 1997. 5 years in preparation. It came out of a failed series of talks with the Taliban, some of them down in Texas, in Houston, where our peerless leaders tried to negotiate safety for pipelines across Afghanistan going east towards the Indian Ocean and west towards Kosovo in Yugoslavia. And the talks failed, and the Taliban was not given in. There were 60,000 troops on maneuvers right around September 11 in the Middle East and also in South Asia. They were NATO troops, they were British, and they were American. And they were poised to move into Afghanistan by mid-October. The BBC disclosed in mid-July that Pakistani high officials and Americans were predicting that hostilities in Afghanistan would open in mid-October. Nothing to do with September 11th. Nothing, absolutely nothing to do with September 11th. So this war is a gigantic scam, and we need to scream this from the housetops. It's a gigantic swindle and scam. It's the biggest lie in our recent history, and we Americans are very, very good at lying. Very good. We've murdered so many people. There's got to be a correlation. We're good at lying. You know? But people like you should not lie. You know? And we need to inform our friends about this deadly nonsense. Notice how I use the word nonsense. It's nonsensicalness.
After his talk, Berrigan took questions from the audience.
Some of us, Phil, don't know the whole story about what came down, you know, on September 11th when you were in the joint. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Right in the next cubicle was a little Chinese guy. His sister worked at the World Trade Center. So he was in a big sweat when the first plane struck the World Trade Center. Asked her whether she was alive or dead. He discovered later on that she was driving in from New Jersey, where she lived, and that things were all clogged up in the tunnels. So she came in by way of Lincoln Tunnel, I think, or Holland Tunnel, and was not able to get through, turned back, in fact, and she went back home. So he was much relieved by that. Anyway, he comes up to me, and he says, "All hell is breaking loose," he says. "A plane just went into the World Trade Center." So I march into, right adjacent to my cubicle, was a large boob tube room. And they had four tubes in there. Two Spanish-speaking stations, because majority of the prisoners I was with were Latinos, and two English-speaking. So I marched in there, and by that time, the second plane had struck, and the towers began to, from the jet fuel, of course, the tremendous heat generated, the towers began to collapse. See? And then a cop comes in the boob tube room, and he says, "Come on, we got to go over to the lieutenant's office." So I go with him, you know, and they got the handcuffs and shackles waiting for me over the lieutenant's office. No IS, no kiss my ass, anything from them. I said, "What's up?" And they said, one of them grunted, "Security." I said, "I'm here." And that happened in New York City. "What do you mean, security?" They marched me up to solitary. And Liz, after not having heard from me because I was completely incommunicado in solitary, no phone calls, no visitors, and wouldn't give me any stamps. I couldn't buy them in the canteen. I couldn't write out. You just have to kind of gulp and go on faith. But Liz smelled a rat, and she started calling the prison and then some of our friends, and they came forward and began to call the prison, and they got very, very antsy there because they can't stand public scrutiny. And after 12 days, they called me down, big meeting with the warden and all of that nonsense, and disclosed with great joy that they were going to release me back into population. They're all grinning at me, you know. They're all showing the teeth. They're all showing the teeth. Happy day. Let's enjoy it together. Yep. There was one Lebanese guy. There was a Palestinian. There was a Jamaican. 13 of us were locked up. None of them had constituencies. None of them had families here in this country. Nobody to intercede for them. They didn't get a one word of explanation as to why they were locked up. Not one word. They did 15, 16 days. If you don't know how to handle silence, it's going to be tough. Because very often you can't get a Bible and you can't get any reading. And the silence is just oppressive. And you do get caught up on sleep enough. But the cells are lovely and clean. It's a new facility. You got a shower there. You've got a sink, a toilet, what have you. You know, it's spanking clean. See? But the tedium gets you. And a lot of these guys locked up with me don't have any tradition of handling silence. They don't pray. They don't read. They don't talk with one another that well. It was very hard on them. I mean, if the bosses and warriors are killing us for whatever reason, and they are, if nuclear war has happened in a way unimaginable to us, what do we do? So a very, very precious book, some friend sent it to prison, and I read it, and it's called A Force More Powerful, and it's a study of nonviolent resistance in the 20th century. So I scoped out the Russian Revolution of 1905 that provided a kind of a remote background for the revolution at the end of World War I. And then Gandhi's work in India, and then the work of Solidarity in Poland. And all of them involved non-cooperation. All of them involved a general strike, where you build over a period of months and years, and then you call a date, and you say, let's bring the most vulnerable aspect of this rotten society, let's bring it down or halt it or check it or hamper it by a strike. And you start out on a gradated level. You start out with non-cooperation. You cut the buying of non-essentials. You don't fly. You don't drive when you don't need to. You cut down on the goodies, because the only soft underbelly that they have is the economy, and this is what they panic over. So you go to students, you go to church people, you go to blue collars, and you go to other elements of the society where you might get a hearing, and you work over a period of months and years, and you build towards a general strike. That's the only thing that I thought made sense in light of what we saw at the Pentagon this morning. See, it's part of my faith that the people are out there, that there are tens of millions of good people here in this country who are appalled by the goings-on. We have fought one foreign war a year since 1945, intervening constantly in the societies of other people and killing on a massive scale, one per year. And all of this does not go unrecognized. People have been betrayed, you see, by the fourth arm of government, which is the media, have been betrayed by them and betrayed by the major institutions, including the church and synagogue. But nonetheless, truth seeps through cracks. And there's a lot of awareness here in this country that things are out of control, that this society is a massive madhouse. It's an asylum. I was thinking of heading for New England, right up to Maine, where we have a lot of friends, and leave one or two or three or four good people per state and outline them and place material at their disposal and keep in contact with them by email and by mail and by telephone, and run with it and do what you can. Make it a modest grassroots effort coming from the people. That's very important. The gospel says you got to come from the margins for any social change. You got to come from the desert. Gandhi used to make a great point of this. He'd say, well, even the infirm, even the wheelchair bound can lead the movement towards liberation. And he realized something that the gospel emphasizes all the time, that it's the spirit that's important. It's the spirit of a person that's important. You know? Not the flesh, but the spirit. It seems to me that there are tens of millions of Americans around who would be appalled at the extent of governmental killing. 650 million people over a period of 56 years. And secondly, they would be appalled at the fact that they're targeted, just like all of us are targeted. Yeah. We don't have any guarantee that we're not going to get sick. And some of us here in this circle are going to die of cancer or related serious disease. And the bosses and warriors are mainly, with our cooperation, responsible for this. It seems to me, you know, Bertel in her first book illustrated the experience of the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto, where the Nazis convinced them that, look, we got no problem with you people, and we're going to resettle all of you on land in Western Russia that we've already cleared. Farmland. It's going to be yours. Gave them their own police force, fire brigades, allowed small businesses, and kept a stranglehold on only two things. One would be food, so that they were enervated and weakened all the time, and the other one would be communications with the outside world. Bertel says we're all in that state now. We're cooperating in our own demise, our own destruction. We're all in that state now. Yeah. And I believe that's an accurate historical analogy. You know, it was broken only when some intrepid young Jew broke out of the ghetto and started following the railroad tracks as they went eastern into Poland, you know, and to Auschwitz and Treblinka and places like that. And he came back and he told what he had found, and his people in the ghetto says, "No, you got to be kidding. You got to be kidding. They're not going to do that to us." But they were. There's this slow assimilation of reality, huh? Where you've been living in a kind of psychological Disneyland for decades now. Decades. See? And you're into denial without even realizing it. And suddenly the bubble bursts. And that's going to be painful, and it's going to be maybe even protracted. But it's got to be burst. And we're the only people around to do it. Who else is there? The institutions have all failed us. The institutions have all failed us. Every major institution here in this country default in its vocation towards the people. We only got one another, and we got God Almighty, and we have the example of our Lord. And that's what we have, and that's more than enough if we say yes to it. Yes. Yeah. As Ellsberg told me 10 years ago after the Pentagon Papers, he says, if we're lucky, we'll be doing this for the rest of our lives. If we're lucky. If we're not blown to kingdom come. And that's eminently sensible, what he said.
Peace activist Philip Berrigan. Special thanks to Jesse Lynn for providing us with a copy of his speech at the Atlantic Life Community Retreat on December 28th. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same tools of electronics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide are used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. 1-800-691-6888, or visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.